This is a podcast from the BBC. For more information and terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
She's an iconic image of the erotic female nude, as she lies seductively, totally naked, wearing not so much as a bracelet or a ring, reclining on two mounds of lacy pillows. Her arms are raised, her hands behind her head, entwined in the black ringlets of her hair, as she looks out at us, brazenly, straight in the eye. Think how shocking this must have been in 1800, when Goya painted his Maja Desnuda, Naked Maja. Years later, he was investigated by the Inquisition for having painted it. 100 years on, Granados was one of many Spanish writers and musicians looking back to Goya's world, their imaginations captured by all things Goyesco. Granados was fascinated by the complex psychology of the painter, by the rich visual detail of his canvases, the range of his palette, and the stories behind his paintings. He wrote a song called La Magia de Goya, which tells of an imagined episode in Goya's life where he's painting his young model, with whom he's enjoying a dalliance, as she poses naked for one of his voluptuous Maja portraits, and then her husband unexpectedly turns up in the studio. Granados told a friend he'd fallen in love with the look of these paintings, that rosy whiteness of the cheeks contrasted with lace and black velvet with jet, those supple-waisted figures with mother-of-pearl and jasmine-like hands resting on black tissue have dazzled me. Goya, a mighty celebrant of pleasure, as Robert Hughes calls him in his brilliant book on the painter, depicted the world he lived in all its infinite variety, from intoxicatingly sensuous beauty, majesty, absurdity and innocence, through to the most nightmarish violence, lunacy, degeneracy and horror. He was a huge influence on the composer Granados, but his later, darker work, which we perhaps now find the most engaging and contemporary in its attitudes, seems not to have appealed to Granados at all. He admired the elegant world he saw Goya reflecting before Napoleon's invasion of Spain in 1808. He loved the portraits, especially the ones he painted of the Duchess of Alba, and his majas and their male companions, the dashing, sexy majos, with their swords, silk stockings, and their suits of lights, the snazzy bullfighter cutaway couture that Goya depicted himself in a famous self-portrait from the early 1790s. It may be that these were really only urban sophisticates posing as earthy bohemians, because there grew up quite a cult of machismo among the upper classes. But in either case, the loose world they inhabited required that they had about them an edge of danger. Quite literally, the man carried a knife in the folds of his brightly coloured sash, and the maja secreted her blade under her skirt. Though he may have drawn his inspiration from Goya and Castilian culture of 100 years previously, Granados was nothing if not versatile. He was himself Catalan. He was born in 1867 in Lleida, halfway between Barcelona and Zaragoza. He'd be drawn to the coast and Barcelona and lived there for most of his life, but Granados wasn't rigidly committed to Catalan nationalism. He was Catalan only by birth. His father was of Cuban ancestry, while his mother came from Santander in Cantabria. Granados reflected the nature of the city he made his home. Barcelona, as a port asserting its Catalan difference, continues to mediate between Castilian Spain and the rest of Europe, and it's been subject to a regular flow of new ideas and influences from abroad. Granados, too, while drawing deeply on his Spanish and specifically Catalan roots, was open to influences from Madrid and Central Europe. His Tonadillas, a collection of songs for voice and piano composed in 1912, were Granados's first works to embody machismo. They look back to the past in that the tonadilla was a form of theatrical entertainment that was popular in Madrid in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, a light diversion that had been played between the acts of something grander. The stories they tell are of the everyday joys and sorrows of the majas and majos of Madrid.
Thank you.
Although Granados had no formal education, he became a refined man of great intelligence. His biographer, Walter Aaron Clark, says he retained a tremendous curiosity about things and that, not having had the formal grounding that most others had, he always exhibited not only a certain humility as a result, but also an openness to new knowledge. Unlike some charming stories of composers being awakened to the beauty of music by their mothers singing lullabies or a nanny or servant singing as they worked, Granados recalled that Rosa, the family cook, made such an appalling noise when she did what she called singing that one not only covered one's ears but also one's nostrils when she sang. His first positive impression was the practicing of a lady harpist who lived next door. He started to imitate what she did on the piano in their apartment and taught himself to play. He had piano lessons from a local teacher until he graduated to Juan Baptista Pujol. It was the great cellist Pablo Casals who described Granados as a born pianist. He made his public debut at the age of 18 in 1886, and despite the relatively late start he'd made, it was his virtuosic talent as a performer that took him abroad to study, as most other Spanish musicians had to do at that time if they wanted to pursue advanced studies and gain credibility with public and critic. Granados went, like most of them, to Paris in 1887, aged 20, where he had private lessons with Charles de Berrio. One of his fellow students turned out to be Ricardo Viñes. Viñes was only a lad of 12 at this time, and the two of them had rooms next to each other in the hotel they lived in the Rue de Trévise. They got up to all sorts of japes and, literally, hijinks. One of their favourite games was to go up on the roof of the hotel and throw loose tiles down into the street and watch them explode in clouds of dust. It didn't make them popular with the neighbours. But there was serious stuff too. They read avidly, mostly novels, but a lot of poetry too, and they also painted. Viñes later noted that water was a constant motif in Granados' pictures, in the form of lakes, lagoons, rivers, and seas. Obviously, Granados found large expanses of water to be a source of inspiration. They would later cause him considerable dread. Granados' earliest musical works appear in a notebook labelled Album, Paris, 1888, which includes a piano duet called En la Aldea, in the village. One movement marks a significant debut appearance among Granados' pieces. La Siesta features what will become a leitmotif in his works, a nightingale's song. The first one came about when he and a couple of friends stayed up all night in Paris copying out a concerto by Berrio that he wanted to take back to Spain with him. They finished their labours at 5 in the morning, and after a breakfast of bread, cheese and wine, Granados was just drifting off to sleep when he heard a nightingale singing. The bird became a kind of talisman for him, and he said its song would always resonate in my soul. Well, despite the difference in their social backgrounds, Amparo Gall y Sabater was obviously taken with Granados' good looks, enough to marry him in the summer of 1893. It took a certain amount of discreet maternal diplomacy to bring about the match and smooth over the difference in status between their two families. Granados' mother wrote to Amparo's, laying her cards on the table. As one mother to another, I must speak with complete honesty. My son is poor, very poor. For now, he has nothing more than a good name. I have no doubt that over time he will be successful, but that will not just happen, and the struggle will be difficult. The prospective bridegroom wrote to his beloved, "How sad that it is not possible to be at once very rich and very poor, for then I would be able to give you what you deserve, and at the same time be worthy of your compassion, which matters more than life itself. Rich for your well-being, poor for your heart." Well, who could resist that? As for Amparo, her biographer wrote of her, "Sweetness and femininity were the essence of her being. She was friendly, simple, organized, and completely faithful to her spouse, whom she loved and admired as the most exceptional man in the world." Granados' biographer, W. A. Clark, points out that the reality was not quite so sugar-coated. She would be required to raise 6 children under constant financial pressure, endure the frequent absences of her husband, and tolerate his roving eye and susceptibility to romantic involvement with young and nubile female students who would have loved to take her place by his side. Looking at the photos we have of Amparo, Clark detects an intensity and will in her flashing eyes. About a year after their wedding, the first of their children was born, a boy they called Eduardo. After a girl and another boy came Victor in 1899, he left us an appealing image of his father. He used to sit on the floor playing with our toys, as if he had been 6. I believe that the toys gave him more satisfaction than they did to us. Granados probably began to compose his Danzas Españolas, Spanish dances, in Paris in 1888, and he dedicated the familiar first piece of the first set to Amparo. Granados was born into tumultuous times. The 19th century in Spain has been described as an epoch of disasters. Following Napoleon's occupation, there were savage wars of independence. She lost her empire in the 1820s. Peru gained its independence in 1824. The French invaded again and restored King Fernando, and there were struggles over the succession to the Spanish crown, with a series of feeble and debauched monarchs bending with whatever wind blew, and acceding to liberal constitutions which were rescinded almost as soon as they were introduced. Coups, scandals, clerical intrigues, and civil war between irreconcilable factions of extreme left and right, the radical Exaltados and the monarchist Apostolicos, were the order of the day, and there were several revolutions, each of which failed, with the most famous, La Gloriosa, in 1868, led by General Juan Prim, when Granados was a babe in arms. He grew up in a period when there was widespread anarchist terrorism and labour unrest. But Granados' hometown of Barcelona, meanwhile, was flourishing culturally. It was already a major industrial and commercial city and now wanted to establish itself on the artistic front. Concert organisations and music schools sprang up, accompanied by parallel initiatives in literature and the visual arts, especially architecture. There was a growing sense of civic pride, which fostered an increasing sense of ethnic and cultural distinctiveness in Catalonia, which saw itself as a land apart. A unique tension existed in Barcelona, the centre of Catalan political separatism, between the inward-looking character of the local Catalanist movement, who wanted to preserve local language and culture, and the outward-looking aspiration to be modern and cosmopolitan. Granados contributed significantly to cultural life in the city, as we'll hear tomorrow, but he didn't commit to any particular camp. He wasn't one to align himself with political causes. He's a perfect reflection of that tension I just mentioned, since he said himself, "I consider myself to be as Catalan as anyone, but in my music I wish to express what I feel, what I admire, and what is attractive to me, whether it be Andalusian or Chinese." Or Polish, one might add, since it's probably Chopin's influence which we can detect in Granados' music, especially when it involves the piano more than any other composer. Here's a classic instance in the virtuosic piano writing of his Piano Quintet of 1894. Thank you. Transformation was a concept Granados was very familiar with. He grew up in Barcelona at a time when the city was a huge building site. His family lived on the Passeig de Gràcia, the wide avenue that's now the tourist showcase for the city's star architectural turns, including Gaudí's La Pedrera and Casa Batlló. It was then a rapidly developing part of the city, and Granados was fascinated by the new buildings springing up and dreamed of being an architect. He used to bring home all sorts of odds and ends he picked up from the construction sites and set about building cathedrals of his imagination in their apartment. Could he have imagined that the Basilica of the Sagrada Familia, which he saw begun as a lad of 17, still wouldn't be finished today? As the shape of the city changed and spread north from the ancient Gothic quarter on the harbour, new organisations blossomed to serve the huge growth in the bourgeois population. Granados played his part in developing musical life, founding performance groups and organising concerts. He founded the Society of Classical Concerts in 1900 and played a role in the foundation of the Orfeo Català, the choral society that went on to be a leading force in Catalan cultural renewal. He kept his distance from it, though. It was too political for him. The more significant development, and not just for Granados, was the music college he founded, the Academia Granados, in 1901. This was a major step forward, since it offered a complete musical education across a wide spectrum of subjects. Teaching was from some of the finest musicians in Barcelona. Though many of the pupils were young women whose aim was to enhance their social graces, the Academia was a serious institution. If you took the full piano curriculum, for instance, it would take you 9 years. Well, those lucky enough to get a place were able to study with one of the finest pianists in Europe for the cost of a cheap ticket to the theatre. A couple of years into the Academy's life, a work which got Granados some serious attention beyond Catalonia was his Allegro de Concierto. As you'll hear, it's a bravura showpiece for solo piano, which he wrote for a competition at the Madrid Conservatoire. As well as his heavy teaching commitments, Granados continued to maintain a career as a performer through the 1890s, and he had some major successes. This was largely out of financial necessity. Money would be a bit of a problem throughout his life. It certainly wasn't because he enjoyed performing in front of an audience. Granados suffered very badly from nerves, which obviously built up as the concert date approached, so that despite his careful preparation, he would be almost overcome by panic. Granados himself explained what was in his mind which unsettled him so much. "If in an audience of 1,000 spectators I know that 999 like me, but one does not, I will play poorly, because for me that one person will be the only one out there, and I know that nothing I do will please him." The demands of teaching and performing didn't leave him much time for composing, and that was something which he came to resent. But luckily, he was able to concentrate and compose virtually anywhere, becoming so absorbed by what was going on in his head that he became totally unaware of his surroundings and even his family. The story goes that someone once saw him working on the orchestration of a piece while riding in a tram. Sometimes, it seems, he would bring performance and composition together in a rather mischievous way, going off on improvisatory flights of fancy. One of his pupils, the soprano Conchita Badia, recalled that one day, during a concert performance of his own piano piece, El Pelele, his pupil, Frank Marshall, who was turning the pages, realised that the maestro was not playing from the music. He continued to turn over, while Granados went on giving flight to his imagination. At the end, there was tumultuous applause and a request for an encore of the piece. This time, Granados played exactly what was written. One of the composer's friends came backstage to congratulate him after the concert and said, "Yes, yes, of course, it was wonderful, but why didn't you repeat the piece the public and I asked for?" In his various tutorials, Granados was concerned with his students' technical as well as artistic development. He realised that the two were inseparable. Students would have two lessons a week in which they'd concentrate on the mechanics in one, where, for instance, he might focus on how the pedal mechanism constitutes the piano's lungs, and the interpretative dimension in the other. He insisted that the interpretation of musical works is parallel to the life of the artist. If he knows the human emotions, expression will flow intuitively, without the artist perhaps being aware of it. His approach, Granados said, was to educate my young students in the poetic sentiment that the entire work must breathe. But he was very specific about correct expression and produced graphs and coloured charts and precise scientific points in lectures about rhythmic flexibility and articulation. On the other hand, in his analysis of music, Granados took a highly subjective approach and relied on poetic, affective images and metaphors, scenic versions featuring lakes with gondolas, enchanted forests, ruined monasteries and erupting volcanoes to guide the pupil's interpretation. His singing pupil, Conchita Badia, like most of her colleagues in his class, was clearly swept away by Granados' eloquent commentaries on the works they were studying and said of his lessons, to hear Granados speaking in class was sheer poetry. Let's hear Conchita Badia herself singing the tonadilla El Mirar de la Maja, the Maja's Gaze. Maja may have a look that can kill, and there was clearly something unusually physically attractive to women about Granados' own eyes. People constantly remark on them. While he may not have had the kind of looks of any of our contemporary film stars, he was something of a magnet to women in his day, with his slim build, his luxuriant handlebar moustache, very much in vogue in Barcelona at the time, his olive skin and mane of thick black hair, and what his biographer W. A. Clarke refers to as those eyes, those liquidy dark orbs of tenderness and sorrow, twin magnets of seductive charm. Another writer says, they gazed into the distance with a distracted air, as though his imagination were in another realm altogether. What seems to have drawn people to Granados, apart from his eyes, was his mixture of strength and vulnerability, and Conchita Badia remarked that he always seemed like an overgrown child. From his wife Amparo's point of view, the less attractive aspect of Granados' eyes was that they had a tendency to wander. A very indiscreet priest is supposed to have reported that he found Granados weeping one day, and when he asked what the matter was, the composer said he was crying over all my sins, offences and transgressions. His transgressions seem to have been mainly of the carnal variety. Amparo had to exercise all of our powers of forbearance from time to time, because we know he had a number of affairs, including with more than one of his students. He dedicated his Escenas Románticas, Romantic Scenes of 1904, to Maria Olivero. The teenage Maria was clearly infatuated with her teacher and wrote impassioned love letters to him, but unfortunately he didn't stash them away very securely, and Amparo found them. She was understandably furious.
You're listening to the podcast version of BBC Radio 3's Composer of the Week with Donald MacLeod.
For Granados, Goya's breathtakingly broad spectrum of work, both on canvas and on paper, the portraits, the caprichos, the disasters of war, the black paintings, together encapsulated the essence of the Spanish character, the very spirit of Spain. The composer's interest in Goya, in common with his fellow countrymen in turn of the 20th century Spain, came as the country, emerging from the defeat it had suffered in its war with the United States in 1898, was looking to its past for glories and great figures as it struggled to redefine itself and establish its place in the world. That was the question of whether Spain should open herself up to the influence of Northern Europe and all its industrial and technological progress, or retrench, turn in on herself, and reject liberal values. In this context, Goya became a symbol of Spanish resilience in the face of defeat, as he had done when Napoleon had invaded Spain at the other end of the century. Sudden bursts of inspiration in response to some specific stimulus were characteristic of the way Granados's compositions came about. His biographer, W. A. Clark, suggests the composer may have been spurred on to create his masterpiece at this particular time because of two unsettling events in 1909. One was the Setmana Tragica, the so-called Tragic Week in Barcelona, when strikers and rioters had taken to the streets in the last week of July that year, overturning trams and setting fire to convents and churches. They were protesting about the calling up of reservists to go and fight in a war against Morocco, whipped up to riotous fury by anarchist agitators. When local troops refused to fire on the workers, forces were brought in from outside Barcelona, and they put down the rioters brutally, causing dozens of deaths. The other pivotal event that year was a single death, the passing of Granados's friend Isaac Albéniz before he'd reached his 49th birthday. Albéniz had been like an older brother to him, and Granados felt his death keenly. The piano cycle Goyescas was swiftly followed by an opera based almost exactly on the piano music. It was created in a bizarre way, making it a very unusual case in opera. Granados got the librettist Periquet to write a storyline to flesh out the original programme of the piano cycle. Granados set this to music and then handed it back to Periquet and told him to set the words to it syllable by syllable, note by note. From the opera Goyescas, we'll hear the classic Maja and the Nightingale, one of the numbers in which the piano part translates well to a vocal line. Why, the Maja wonders, does the nightingale sing its beautiful song in the darkness? Granados set out clear instructions for the performer of the piano version of The Maja and the Nightingale to play with the jealousy of a wife and not the sadness of a widow. Well, that was an area in which Granados had more expertise than most. That movement's dedicated to his wife Amparo, who by this stage must have been aware of her husband's affair with Clotilde Godeau. The occasional brief fling with a pretty teenage student was one thing, but Amparo recognised that this was something else. In fact, it was one of Granados's most talented pupils, Paquita Madriguera, who caught her teacher in flagrante delicto with Signora Godeau in his room at the Academy in Barcelona. Clotilde Godeau, who was born in 1885, making her about 12 years younger than the composer, lived to be an astonishing 103. At the time she was discovered in compromising circumstances with Granados, she was a vivacious and attractive socialite, the daughter of a wealthy industrialist who'd been married off at the age of 18. But the marriage proved to be so unhappy and so unfortunate that it was annulled by the Pope. She was something of a piano prodigy herself, so she was actually having legitimate lessons from Granados. In his biography of the composer, W. A. Clark reproduces a couple of amazing posed studio photographs of the couple. She's got up as a maja, complete with mantilla and an alluringly décolleté dress of some kind of lacy material. Clotilde is a very buxom woman. Clark writes of an electricity in their gazes, but they're not looking at each other in either of these photographs. In both pictures, Granados seems to be transfixed in contemplation of Clotilde's bosom. We can see, propped up on the music stand, the cover of the first edition of Goyescas with an engraving of one of his Capriccio pictures, Tal para cual, which depicts a maja using her charms on an elegantly dressed young chap. And here are Clotilde and Granados echoing that flirtatious image. Amparo knew about their affair, and so did the composer's descendants, but they preferred to preserve his reputation untarnished by such revelations of his human fallibility. According to Paquita Madriguera, this was a very serious affair indeed. A great passion ignited the hearts of the maestro and his student. Their passion was worthy of inclusion in the history of famous love affairs, especially as it ended, like most, with death coming between them. It was during this emotionally turbulent time in his life that Granados composed Escenas Poéticas. There are four movements, their titles reminiscent of Schumann's Scenes from Childhood, Memory of Distant Lands, The Angel of the Cloisters, Margarita's Song, and The Poet's Dreams. These dreams are disturbed by Granados's first hallucinatory reference to El Amor y la Muerte, Love and Death, the fifth of his Goyescas. Granados kept a notebook in which he'd jot down musical ideas for the piano cycle Goyescas, as well as making drawings of majas in various flirtatious poses. When he'd completed the cycle, he wrote an introduction revealing how important this work was to him, how much it was a labour of love. "I have concentrated my entire personality in Goyescas. I fell in love with the psychology of Goya and his palette, with his ladylike maja, his aristocratic majo, with him and the Duchess of Alba, his quarrels, his loves and flatteries." Granados also made clear what his intentions were in the cycle. "I should like to give a personal note in Goyescas, a mixture of bitterness and grace, and I desire that neither of these two phases should predominate over the other in an atmosphere of delicate poetry. Great melodic value, and such a rhythm that it often completely absorbs the music. Rhythm, colour, and life distinctly Spanish. The note of sentiment, as suddenly amorous and passionate as it is dramatic and tragic, as it appears in all of Goya's work." Goya's series of aquatints called Caprichos, whims or fantasies is how that name would usually be understood, were intended as social commentaries. They had backgrounds of deep, mysterious blacks and greys, so that the figures set against them seemed both solid and real, and yet otherworldly at the same time. So now, from Goyescas, we'll hear Quejas, or La Maja y el Ruiseñor, Laments, or the Maja and the Nightingale. We heard the song Granados made of it yesterday, and this is the original. Alicia de la Rocha said, "Here is the most tender and at the same time the most intensely passionate music Granados ever wrote." Thank you. It's very easy to imagine the melodic line being sung. And there were a number among the audience who first heard that music as part of a suite in 1911 who thought just that. It was apparently the American pianist Ernest Schelling who suggested to Granados that he turn his piano score into an opera. The way the composer went about this conversion operation was really bizarre. Granados had met the journalist Fernando Periquet, who was then a very young man, through his friend Isaac Albéniz, and the two of them got on very well. They were both devotees of Goya. It seems Granados may have got Periquet to sketch out a very broad scenario in the first instance, and then, Periquet tells us, Granados wrote his enchanting score without words, in absolute liberty, visualising in his mind's eye the entire cavalcade of Goya-esque characters, majas, duchesses, royal guards, witches and witches' sabbaths. Granados was working in a hurry, and so made a straight orchestration of the piano music, making remarkably few changes. Once the music was all done, he handed the score over to Periquet, who had to fit the words to the music note by note. This led to some awkward moments, such as when he found himself with just four notes in which to get the two main male characters to agree to fight a duel. There can be few instances in the history of opera where a librettist has been obliged to work within such a constrictive straitjacket. Periquet said, "I made of my libretto the simplest story that I have ever written." Simple is one way of putting it. The libretto has been the major target for critical attack. Granados hoped that Goyescus would have its premiere in Barcelona in 1914, but all kinds of obstacles got in the way of that, and in fact the opera wasn't seen in Barcelona until after Granados' death. Fortunately, the New York Met were interested, and the premiere was slated for January 1916. This would be the first ever Spanish-language production at the house. In the year in which the Lusitania sank, Granados's dread of ocean voyages was at its most acute, and he and his wife had premonitions that they wouldn't return to Spain alive. They said goodbye to their friends on the quayside as if these were last farewells. In the event, it was a tough journey with bad weather for almost the entire crossing of the Atlantic, which took 15 days rather than the usual 10. Goyescus isn't in acts, but pictures or tableau, as seems appropriate, with scenes from Goya as the inspiration. The outline of the story is that the bullfighter, Paquiro, who's engaged to Pepa, is trying to woo the beautiful Rosario, but she already has a lover, Fernando, a captain in the Royal Guard. At a dance, the two rivals meet, pick a quarrel, and agree to fight a duel. We'll hear the first scene, where Pepa arrives in her dog cart, while Rosario, her upper-class rival in love, turns up in a sedan chair. According to Granados, in his own imagination, Fernando was actually Goya, while Rosario was the Duchess of Alba, who was supposedly his lover. The first night turned out to be a huge success, at least as far as Granados was concerned. He wrote home, "I've landed on my feet here. There is a magnificent atmosphere." The sets were very beautiful, stunningly accurate evocations of scenes painted by Goya. The designer went to the Prado in Madrid to study the pictures and get all the details right. The Spanish-speaking population of New York were out in force, and they took the piece to their hearts. They applauded like mad, but were crying at the same time. Granados was delighted and was making a small fortune in the States. He wrote home that he had a world of ideas for future works, including a sequel to the Goyescus piano cycle with a suite of pieces inspired by Goya's caprichos. He was scheduled to leave the USA on a Spanish liner on the 8th of March, but decided to delay his departure, understandably, since he'd received an invitation to the White House for a gala event to perform for President and Mrs. Wilson. He could hardly refuse, after all. So he changed his itinerary from a Spanish vessel to a Dutch liner, the Rotterdam, and the trip would involve a stopover in Britain with a channel crossing a few days later. As they prepared for their journey home from New York, perhaps imagining a triumphal reception, both Granados and Amparo had disturbing premonitions of their deaths. Amparo became hysterical, convinced she'd never see her children again. But this time, the transatlantic crossing to Britain was uneventful and took only 8 days. After a stopover in London, sightseeing and visiting friends, they joined the other 400 passengers aboard the Sussex at Folkestone on the 24th of March, with clear skies and calm sea. The ship left harbour at 1:30, bound for Dieppe. At 2:55 p.m, the skipper detected a menacing disturbance in the water. Captain Henri Mouffet saw a torpedo approaching to port at a distance of about 100 yards. He ordered an immediate change of course, but the vessel was still turning when the torpedo struck and destroyed the bow of the ship. The Sussex didn't sink because the explosion had bent the steel plates of the hull inwards, stopping the water from flowing in. An American professor aboard the ship recalled that the explosion came without warning, a sudden shock, not too loud nor too sharp, followed by a wave of debris and water thrown up and over. A moment of silence, then all hell let loose. The scenes around us were harrowing. The water full of men and women, swimming, sinking, drowning, clinging to spars, boards and other bits of wreckage, crying out in the agony of the last hold on life. Mario Serra, a friend of the Granados's, gave his account of the final minutes of the composer's life. The two were separated in the water, and Enrique tried to reach Amparo. Ironically, Amparo was a good swimmer, but he was not. He embraced his wife, and they disappeared forever beneath the waves. In the panic and confusion, no one thought to or was able to help them. While Granados was in New York, he recorded some piano rolls on the Duo Art reproducing piano, though of course they weren't issued until after his death. From that ghostly legacy, this is one of those immensely poignant records of the composer playing his own Reverie. When an artist friend of theirs went to a makeshift morgue in Boulogne to look for the bodies of Granados and his wife Amparo, he didn't find them. The press and public held out the hope that they still might turn up among the survivors. They didn't, but almost all their personal effects were recovered from the ship, which hadn't sunk after the attack, including the score of the opera Maria del Carmen. The circumstances of Granados' death generated great public sympathy for their family, as well as a sense of moral outrage. Why had the German submarine attacked a passenger vessel? Oberleutnant Herbert Pustkuchen claimed to have mistaken the Sussex for a mine layer, a military vessel, because of its flat stern. The German government initially denied any culpability, but fragments of torpedo were found in one of the lifeboats. The episode was certainly used by the Allies to highlight the savagery of their opponents. The wave of public feeling was enormous. People queued to leave messages in books of condolence. There were fundraising memorial concerts for the Granada's orphans. Sir Thomas Beecham conducted one at the Aldwych Theatre in London, and Pablo Casals performed in another concert in New York. When Alicia de la Rocha died in September 2009, a leading news agency referred to her as the greatest Spanish pianist in history. She represented an important part of Granados' legacy, since she was one of the pupils of Frank Marshall, who can trace a line directly back to the composer. When Granados died, Marshall found himself in charge of the Granados Academy in Barcelona, which continues to play a prominent role in Barcelona's musical life. It's perhaps in his effect on music education that Granados's legacy rests most securely. Granados's legacy as a composer is more problematic, since when he died, so many of his works were unpublished. This accounted for 104 of the 250 piano pieces he composed. And, of course, he died tragically, just as his future was beginning to look very bright indeed. One work which shows us a path he might have pursued if he'd lived is a substantial symphonic poem called Dante. Interestingly, the inspiration here derives not from the Divine Comedy, but, as so often with Granados, from a painting, this time by Dante Gabriel Rossetti. As you'll hear, the music reveals the influence of both Wagner and Richard Strauss. It should have been even longer, since these are only two of the four movements Granados intended, called Dante and Virgil, and then Paolo and Francesca. We get a clear idea of Granados' intentions from what he said about the fourth never-completed movement. "I want to paint with the orchestra. Those violet, carmine and green hues of Rossetti's painting have impressed my eyes so immensely that my ears will settle for nothing less. I want to feel music of that colour." Another student of Granados's who ensured his name lived on was the singer Conchita Badia, whom we've already heard from this week. She recalled joining in a touching homage to the composer. 11 years after his death, as a tribute to the artist lost to the world, his family, together with a few friends, including Frank Marshall, Manuel de Falla and myself, went down to the quayside of Barcelona port. There, Frank Marshall threw a sealed bottle into the sea as a posthumous offering to a cherished friend. The bottle contained excerpts from Beethoven's third sonata, Goyescas, and fragments of Falla's Retablo de Maese Pedro. The endless ocean engulfed a boundless source of poetry and inspiration. The world of music had lost one of its greatest and most lyrical devotees.
You've been listening to the podcast version of Composer of the Week, presented by Donald MacLeod. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you can find complete Composer of the Week programmes on BBC Radio 3, Monday to Friday at noon, and repeated at 10 p.m.